Hi folks, hope you're well. My name is Jim Carroll. Welcome you to the latest podcast from the Banter team. We're heading back to the Ballymaloe Lit Fest in May, and here's a taste of what we did at the premier food festival in the country last year. It's an interview with David Lebovich, food writer, author, and former Chef's Panisse pastry guru. It's one for anyone with a sweet tooth.
Hi folks, welcome along to the first banter at the... Joe, thank you very much. Thanks very much. Give a big round of applause to Joe McNamee. Joe will be back tomorrow with more all-star cast for the Rants, Rays and Rula Boulia from tomorrow, so check that. This is Banter. My name is Jim Carroll. How's it going? Hope you're all well. Thanks very much for coming along. Would you please... Banter is a kind of a well-travelled series of public talks and interviews in which we talk about all kinds of shite. There's a lot of ranting and raving going on.
What was that word?
Yeah, shite. Shite. S-H-I-T-E. Shite. Okay. Have you heard that word before, David?
No. Not with that accent.
Okay, and I talk very fast as well, so I'll slow down because I'm in Cork. Would you please give a Oh, I'm winning.
You're supposed to say, I'll slow down for the American. Then you get a cheer from everybody.
Anyway, this has been a long rambling instruction. Would you please give a warm round of applause, please, to David Lebovich. Hi. How are you finding your time at Ballymaloe so far, David?
It's great. I love coming here. I came a few years ago, and it was amazing, and my dream was to come back. And when they invited me back, I got the email. I was like, I said, yes. I think I answered within like 4 seconds.
Okay. You were in the middle of the market this morning. What'd you buy?
What did I buy or what did I taste?
Both.
One of the problems with traveling a lot is you can't buy everything and you can't taste everything. But I've learned to eat as much as you can when you're there. And you don't have to bring everything home. I lead tours of Paris. I tell people, you don't have to own it. You just have to enjoy it. Because everyone, especially, is there any Americans here? I mean, we always want to buy stuff. Everyone's like, I have to buy this, I have to buy this, I have to buy this. I'm like, you know what? Just be there in the moment. So I ate a bunch of different goat cheeses. I was with Rebecca, and I told some French people to try them too, and they were like, oh, c'est pas mal. I had a wonderful, I didn't have coffee. That was the longest line. There were some beautiful smoked salmon. They weren't offering samples. But I got lots of pictures.
Okay.
And my memories of Cork.
Exactly. Hey, your list of foods there, Dave, didn't include anything sweet. And like, you know, you're known primarily as a man with a sweet tooth. So when you think back and go back...
I don't like sweets. It's funny, people say, you don't like sweets, you met your pastry chef. I actually like things that are strong and bitter. Like I like bitter honey, like buckwheat honey. I like chocolate, I like coffee. I like citrus fruits and things. I like strawberries. And I don't think of those things as sweet. I think like sugar sweet. Violet syrup is sweet, you know. Candy bars you buy at the supermarket are sweet. I don't make things that I think are sweet.
the list of food produce, you know, that's to many people that's desserts and that's sweet stuff as well. Mm-hmm. So like, when you were growing up, were you a kid who was attracted to candy? Were you a kid who were attracted to kind of like honey? Were you a kid who was kind of putting his hand in the biscuit jar all the time?
I grew up actually, most Americans were mixed heritage. So I grew up Syrian and Scandinavian. So we had a lot of things like apricots and pistachios and honey and stuff like that. So I grew up with that. We didn't have a lot of junk food as I was growing up, which is good. It was there. And I remember once asking my mother why we never had that. I saw the TV ads. I was like, why don't we ever have that stuff at home? She's like, no. So I didn't grow up eating all that stuff. I was actually attracted to pastry because I'm a very analytical person. There was a salad dressing that came out in the United States called Good Seasons. And the whole premise was they'd sell you this carafe with a little stopper and a package of spices and seasonings. And on the carafe, it would say vinegar, water, oil. And you'd pour the vinegar, you'd pour the oil right up to that level. And then you'd put the spices in. And that was my first baking project. So I was kind of fascinated by measuring things. And that's why people always complain about Americans and cups, using cups and tablespoons. I'm like, well, it's nice. You know, we were in the kitchen yesterday making bread with Tim, and there are these beautiful tablespoons here that you just want to cry. It's like, scales are very nice, but I don't want to cry when I use a scale. Well, sometimes when it runs out of batteries and you live in Paris and there's none of the places are open to get batteries, you have to baking project.
So. Oh, at what point did it become apparent to you that your life lay, at least in the early years, in professional kitchens?
Was when I was started at Chez Panisse. I started working there in 1983, I believe.
You were just like 12 then, weren't you?
No, I just acted like I was 12. You can ask Alice when you see her, what was David like? She'll be like, ay. But when I realized I was in this very serious, and I hate to say the word incubator, but it's a very topical word right now. It's a place where people really are into cooking, and it's like Ballymallow. I've been saying Ballymallow for 15 years, and now it's like Ballymallow. Okay, sorry. So apologies to everybody in Ireland.
Yeah, well, don't worry. One of our associates refers to it as Ballymoola.
Okay, well, you don't give a shite? You say, okay,
yes.
Thank you. I don't give a shite. There we go. I'm going to get in trouble. I won't be invited back next year, so I hope you all enjoy this year. But then, I was working in this place where everybody, it's a really great place to cook because Alice, like, money is no object, which is very unusual. You know, if you go in the kitchen here, Darina, she's not like, don't use that because it's too expensive. It's like, just use it, make good food, and everything else will follow or not. So Chez Panisse, I was around all these people. Everybody there was just into good cooking and cooking well. And it was very, very busy. It was very hard. When I started at Chez Panisse, the moment we opened the door at 5 o'clock, there was a line out the door down to the sidewalk. It didn't stop till 11:30, and that was when we had to shut the doors because the neighborhood association said we couldn't serve food after 11:30. So it was very intense. I am exhausted just thinking about it.
You said in an interview a couple of years ago that one of the things I've done my research.
Now the hard questions.
if I can remember them. Yeah. You said that one of the things about Chez Panisse was the sensibility. I mean, during that time in the 80s, like cooking began to change. It began to take more awareness of local produce, and it began to take kind of like more awareness of kind of like how those ingredients worked. And you referred to you used that lovely word sensibility. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you look back now, I mean, what other words would you associate with that time besides kind of graft and sweat?
Red wine. It was just, it was actually exploration and learning. People would come to the back door of the restaurant with these bags of Meyer lemons, and they had a tree, and sure, we'll take them, and we had to figure out what to do with them. Somebody started making goat cheese, and now it's ubiquitous, but we didn't, it's like, oh, goat cheese, what do we do with it? So we actually looked to France and Italy for a lot of inspiration. That's what Chez Panisse was sort of founded on, that whole idea of cuisine du marché. So we were very inspired by that. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, it does. No, it does.
I think I went somewhere else.
Yeah, it was a good exploration. Okay. Drink some water.
No, it's just going somewhere else.
Okay. Okay. I like this. This is the first banter with mime and movement involved.
Okay.
And shite.
At
what stage then did you decide it was time for you to kind of like to go to Paris? I mean, was it a decision to go there? Was it based on some practical reasons? Was it a kind of flight of heart?
My back. A rush? I couldn't stand up anymore.
Really?
No. I started in the restaurant business, or I sort of flourished in the restaurant business, which is a stupid word, but don't tweet that because everyone already.
We're podcasting it right now.
Thank you. Okay.
I'm meerkatting it.
It was a time when a lot of people wanted to become cooks, and everybody was really into cooking. And then we all turned 40, and we were like, oh, I'm tired, and I can't go out at night, and I can't stand up for 12 hours, and I have to, I have to eat, and I want to eat sitting down for a change. So I left the restaurant business, and I was like, what do I do with my life? All of a sudden, I was like, what do you do with, when you're a surgeon or you're working insurance, you have a retirement. When you're a restaurant cook, you don't have anything, or depending on where you work. Some places do, but, and Chez Panisse is sort of a big family. But I didn't know what to do with my life. And I had written I should back up slightly. I had proposed to Alice writing the second Chez Panisse dessert book because Lindsay Shear, who was the pastry chef and owner of the restaurant, had written the first one, which is a lovely book. But a lot had changed between the time she had written that book and that time. And not necessarily changed, but I had also added a lot of things to the Chez Panisse repertoire, and we all had. It was a very... Collaborative, thank you. So I wrote my first book. Alice was very, you know, she was very encouraging. She said, you should go and write your own book. In other words, you know. So which was very good advice. I mean, she cared very much about me. And I did. And that, you know, the book came out and it was successful. There was an article in the New York Times about it, a very nice review by somebody who, Amanda Hesser, who got it. You always wonder, like, are people going to get my book? Like, if you look at Darina's books, they're fabulous. But somebody could be like, oh, this is crazy. You can't make all this stuff. And you have to look past that and see this beautiful book, this beautiful food, and this whole philosophy she's espousing. So the book got good reviews, but I didn't really have anything else to do. So I decided to move to Paris for no reason.
Okay, so
I didn't speak French. I didn't have any friends. I didn't know where to live. I had one suitcase. And
you had three suitcases.
I did. Well, at the time, I could take three. Yeah, right. At the time, you could take three suitcases on the plane. Now it's one. So I feel bad for the people moving nowadays. Although we usually pay for the extra one now. We call it the expat tax.
So. Okay, so you land in Paris then with your three suitcases, not having a word of French in your head. Well, yeah. you obviously have some words of French in your head. You know, like, okay, but yeah. Bonjour, merci. But like, you know, so the one thing that you've done persistently over the time you've been in Paris, and I have to admire you for this, is the blog and the website. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it's a great showcase of what you do and what you're about, and like, I mean, your thoughts and your kind of philosophy. You know, mm-hmm. But like, were you at that stage when you arrived there? Were you looking for work, or were you kind of saying, I've had enough of the restaurant kitchens?
I had kind of stopped working. You know, I have a back problem. I was like, I can't stand up, you know, for 10 hours anymore, so forth. That's why I'm enjoying sitting here. This is very nice. I wasn't looking. I wanted to be a writer, and I was going to talk about this tomorrow, but this is a sneak preview. I thought, well, you know, I'm American in Paris. I can write for all these American food magazines about all these little pastry shops I'm finding and all these cool. There's a lot of young people. It was sort of a little era in France where some of the pastry chefs were quitting their jobs in the chic shops and opening in neighborhoods because it was cheaper. They could be more neighborhood-oriented rather than worry about everything looking perfect and so forth. And the magazines didn't want me to write for them, and they weren't interested. They go, well, can't you write about La Durée and the big places? I was like, well, everybody knows to go to La Durée. There's this guy who's in the 6th, or not the 6th, the 12th, who's doing these croissants that are amazing. They're like, well, nobody cares. I was like,
did you find out, like, David, that the French diners and French food fans cared?
Not at first. You know, it was funny because I started blogging in 1999 before people really knew what a blog was, before I knew it wasn't really even called a blog. And I just kept writing and writing and writing and sharing things. And once in a while, somebody might comment. I was like, oh, somebody I don't even know. And it was, I probably had like three readers a week, literally. I don't, you know, one was like my best friend in San Francisco. One was me, you know, going back to correct it. You know. Another one was my webmaster, you know, uploading the file. And then in 2004, there was blogging software. And that was kind of when I sort of moved to Paris. And I thought, oh, I can update it more easily, or easier. I can update it easily. And I started writing about all these things. And it's funny, if you read blogs that are old, you go back. I mean, it's funny for me to go back and look at like 2006, what I was writing. It's really crazy. And it's a sickness if you go back and look at your old blog posts because you start correcting things. You know, when you write a cookbook, it's there. The good thing about a blog is you can correct it. The bad thing is you can correct it. So it's kind of funny, but it's your history and it's okay. You know, it's 15 years ago, but I was writing about stuff in Paris that was not necessarily the stereotypical view of Paris that people often write about.
So I mean, like, I'm curious about those kind of fabulous croissant shops you were finding, you know, and like, you know, the fact that like you've also kind of like said recently in interviews and on your blog that growth in kind of like it's not so much fast casual, but like the less formal restaurants that like, I mean, are taking over. That you've got chefs who are out there who are putting themselves out there, who are trying things out, different menus, that whole idea. Do you think, you know, that like, I mean, the Parisian diners are going for that, or is there still a kind of like a serious subsection of Parisian diners who want the old school stuffy bistros and starch white tablecloths?
It's actually the reverse. A lot of people come to Paris and they're like, we want to go to like an old bistro. And French people, Parisians don't really eat that way anymore, especially the young people. Young people don't really want to eat coq au vin and potato gratin and cassoulet, they want to have something like, you know, a salad with quinoa or something without dressing. But stuff like that. They're still evolving in that direction. They haven't gotten there yet. But the young French chefs don't really want to cook that food either. That's, they call it the cuisine de grand-mère, the cuisine of my grandmother. And it's one, they like eating it when they go visit their grandmother, but to them, they want to make their mark doing something else. And is anyone here French? Oh, hello. Hi. So, you know, it's not in the French culture to do something different, to strike out on your own. It's sort of considered, you know, you want to stay with, be traditional. French people really like tradition, their heritage, the patrimoine, they call it. But the young chefs, this is called Generation Croisée, which means the cornered generation, you'd say in English, maybe blocked generation. So there's these young group of chefs, they're called the Generation Croisée, and they're trying to do like new things, and it's not always successful, but if you don't make mistakes, you know, you never learn, you never go forward. You always, as a cook, you throw things away or whatever, you put it in the compost if you're here. I would love to compost. We don't have composting in Paris. But I found all these people doing all this stuff, and it was so cool, and they were so nice, and I really wanted people to go there. Like, if you were going to Paris, I'd want you to go to this, like, croissant. People come to Paris, they're like, where can we go get a really good croissant? I'm like, well, you gotta take the metro and get off here and walk. But then you go to this place, and they were super nice. They had this amazing pastry, and people love finds. People always write to me, like, we want to find like an unknown bistro. There's no tourists. I'm like, but you're a tourist. What's wrong with tourists? Yeah. But you know, people had this whole thing and they want to find a hidden secret spot. So I was writing about places that you wouldn't necessarily know about. And of course, a lot of people now are doing that as well. I guess I was one of the first. I don't want to make myself sound more important than I am. Or was. Now I'm not important anymore. Because everyone else is doing it. But anyhow, that's what I really liked doing. And when I write about restaurants, I was talking to somebody yesterday about writing restaurant reviews. I said, well, I don't review restaurants. What I do is I point people to places I think they'll enjoy. And the food might not be fantastic, but I know that they would have a really good time there. And they get treated nicely, and it would be interesting for people to go to. Mm. And now you're seeing the media starting, I mean, now, the last few years, people are starting to write about the other sides of Paris.
Yeah. When you moved to Paris in the first place, I mean, you'd come from the west coast of the States, so you'd access San Francisco, you knew San Francisco as a good food city, you knew
the
New
best.
York.
New after York's Cork.
After Cork, yeah. After Middleton. After Middleton.
Cork, yeah.
Yeah, after Middleton. And you also knew New York. You know, how did Paris stack up? I mean, has Paris changed as a food city in that time? Not so much in terms of restaurants, but just in terms of like how they regard food and the provenance of food.
Well, the United States, I can't really speak about Ireland, but I'm kind of assuming it's the same curve as the UK is the same as America. We had this huge dive. It was all of a sudden everybody, you know, in the 60s, everybody was frozen food and so forth. And now, you know, 10 years ago, everyone started going, oh my God, what have we done with our food? You know, now let's have these farmers markets. Let's, you know, build cooking schools and so forth. And that's just starting to happen in France because I don't think they saw how far that they had gone, how they didn't adapt to modernization very well. And they kind of took to it really fast. And now you have these hypermarchés, they call them like hyper supermarkets, which you probably have here as well. We have them in America too, but they're very popular. They're huge supermarkets, and a lot of the stuff is kind of gross inside of them. And they have some good stuff too. I mean, I go to them and buy coffee and whatever, so forth. But they don't have any in Paris. But it took them a while because I used to talk about it. I say, well, this restaurant's not very good, and my friends are like, oh, it's really good. And now they go, yeah, it's not so good. There's a whole recognition. I mean, whenever you have a problem, the first step is admitting you have a problem. As you know, people have alcohol problems and so forth. The first thing is saying, oh, yeah, I have a problem. We'll get to my problems tomorrow. But you have to recognize it's a problem. And a lot of the French chefs are starting to say, we have a problem here. French cuisine is getting a bad reputation. When I came to Cork last time, this Irish fellow said to me, oh, I just came back from Paris and the food was bloody awful. I was like, well, you know, Matt, just in the terms of, you know, it's funny to hear an Irish person, you have a bad reputation, and so does America having bad food, where in fact the food here is spectacular. And so it was funny to hear an Irish person saying that and kind of sad at the same time, too. So the French in some ways have turned their back on their cuisine in some ways. But I think it's actually more, how do you bring it into the here and now? The Scandinavians did it with this sort of Nordic food, and the, you know, you've done it here at Ballymaloe, with the, you know, just bringing back these food traditions, and same with Middle Eastern food. People like Yotam Ottolenghi and the Honey and Company folks, they're doing Middle Eastern food, but they've managed to bring it to somewhere modern, fresh, and contemporary. And that's the big question, I think, for France. In spite of the bad stories you hear about French cuisine, there's amazing cheeses, there's amazing bakeries, there's amazing chocolates and so forth, which don't get talked about as much anymore. It's just kind of a given. So,
you said something very interesting earlier on when we were talking about the blog, David. I mean, you said that with the blog, you can go back and change things. You can go back and change the HTML code. But with the cookbook, that's it. It's done. How did you...
I change old cookbooks. I send letters to the public. Next printing, can you do that?
Yeah. But as someone who's got used to the blogging kind of mentality and the fact that, like, you know, it's so fluid, it's so up to date, it's so current. Like, when you approach cookbooks, what's the approach there? I mean, like, is it, do you have a different head on you, different headset on you when you're doing it?
Well, the hard thing about having a blog is you get so accustomed to people asking you every possible question. I had a recipe for roasted peppers, which you grill them and you take the skin off and you put just. And somebody asked, I don't like peppers. Can I use something else? And so, you know, you have to preface every recipe. Well, if you don't like peppers, you know, you can use eggplant, maybe. You know, so, if you have butter in a recipe, someone's going to want to use margarine. If you want to have applesauce in your cake, someone's going to want to think you use... So you start writing these blog posts, and the whole thing is apologizing or telling people, like, if you don't like flour, you feel gluten-free, you know. It's okay, because the whole idea of a blog sometimes is a conversation, but on the other hand, it's like...
So I feel your pain.
Yeah. So when you write a book, I think a book is two things. A book is a more of a lasting story. Like when you look at Dorina's older books, they tell a story of a certain place and time. And she probably would say, oh, I want to change that recipe, or I'd like to do it differently now. When I write a book, especially nowadays, if you want a recipe, you can get a recipe online. If you want a recipe for hummus, you don't need to buy someone's cookbook to get the recipe. You just tap Honey and Company hummus, and I'm sure their recipe is in some newspaper or magazine. A book should tell a story of a restaurant or a life. So the Honey and Company book is about, it's like a record album. It's a bunch of songs together that make a whole. When I wrote my last book, My Paris Kitchen, I was like, well, who cares about French recipes anymore? Because they're all, you can get them online. And I realized that the recipes told my story. So the book is sort of a half cookbook, half memoir, that tell a linear story. And I wanted to tell the story of my last 5 years of my life. So I think a book is a more lasting history. One thing, the French are really into archiving things and paperwork and their history. And that stuff kind of needs to be written down in a way. We're kind of losing, you know, all these tweets and stuff. I saw these amazing tweets, but they're all gone. Someone was talking about Snapchat, which the picture goes away after 5 seconds. So there's something to be said, and cookbooks are still selling, which is great. I mean, the book market's a disaster, but books are selling because the internet has not replaced cookbooks. It's replaced people looking for recipes, but a lot of recipes also don't work on the internet too. That's a big problem.
No, it's an interesting idea. Like, I mean, that cookbook is the story. You know, that if people want, like me, hear the story of that restaurant, hear the story of that chef, that's where they're going to go and find that out. To conclude, I'm going to ask for some questions for the audience to conclude. But okay. I mean, let's go back to where we began. You know, in many ways, talking about, like, I mean, your sweet tooth. You know, if we put you to the kind of pillar right now and put a gun to your head,
close the tent.
What would be your all-time favorite dessert? Well, like, I mean, this stage, you're going to wow all the people here at Ballymaloe's banter, okay. But your all-time favorite dessert, what would it be?
Okay. Everyone's going to get, they're all going to, you can tweet that I contradicted myself. I say I don't like sweet things. I love, there's a French dessert called Floating Island, which is creme anglaise and meringue on top with caramel. And it's not super sweet. I mean, you can make it as sweet as you want, but I love it. It's got super, caramel has to be super, if you talk to French people, they would say, oh, mon souvenir, it's like my grandmother made something. It's a great, and I love it more than anything. I don't know why I like it so much. Sometimes I order one and my friends are like, oh, c'est pas bon. I'm like, oh, I love this.
Final question for me, David, and thank you very much for your time. Say there's going to be, you're walking around Ballymaloe and a magic fairy comes on and hits you on the back and your back problems are gone. You could go back to restaurants in the morning, would you?
One thing that's hard about what I do or what anybody does who works at home is you're alone. You're not collaborating. And cooking is a collaboration. It's like, taste this. Will you taste, what do you think of this? And that's why social media, I think, has become very important for people, especially who work online. I have a lot of friends who are bloggers and we never meet in person, or we do once in a while, but we collaborate online. Like, what are you doing about this? Have you had this problem with your site? Or, do you know about how to make ice? People write to me about ice cream. How should I answer that to readers? So we've formed another sort of community. Is that the answer to the question?
Yeah.
So is this the coffee talking?
Yeah. It's good. What you miss by working alone is collaboration. Now you have that collaboration via social media. It's your water cooler.
Yeah. And I miss talking to people. And that's why when I come to these things, like I was here a few days earlier and I networked with the people that are speakers, some of whom I don't know and some of whom I've just, met, or some people who I have known for years. And it's really nice, and we keep in touch, and we have new friends, and it's really nice. So things like this are very important. Unfortunately, I don't get to travel much because I'm always working, but I'm trying to change. I'm trying to retire. I have to write 2 more books and write blog, like 12 blog posts, and I just took 300 pictures yesterday, so for this.
Okay, we've got time for some questions from the floor, if anyone's got some questions before we let David go. Don't be shy. Okay. Wow, we've covered everything.
Okay.
That's great.
I think we both talk really fast.
I talk loads of shite. So please give a round of applause to David Labossis.
Thanks.
Thanks a million to David for joining us at Banter at Ballymaloe, and thanks to Rebecca Cronin and all our team at the festival for inviting us along. This podcast was produced by Banter series producer Tanya White. You can check out thisisbanter.com for news of what we're up to at Banter. Plus, you can also listen back to all the Banter podcasts to date. And check litfest.ie for details of this year's festival. We'll be back next week with another podcast. Until then, goodbye and take care.